Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today by an acclaimed visual artist and very independent filmmaker. She's known for her short films that combine music and ambient sound with multiple animation styles and techniques. Gail Noonan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, right now you're being celebrated by the Northwest Film Center in Portland. They've brought you down from British Columbia as one of the trailblazing women of independent animation. This is good company to be in.
Oh, I am so pleased to be with those other wonderful trailblazers. I feel very honored to be in their company.
Yeah, they're an amazing group of Northwest artists that include Ruth Hayes from Olympia, Washington, Joan Gratz, two-time Academy Award winner, plus Rose Bond, Joanna Priestley, and Marilyn Zornato.
No, I'm more than pleased and tickled pink and honored. And, you know, I was telling my friends back home, I guess I have to fall off my perch now. I'm having a retrospective. That's it. I'm done. I'm finished. Over.
Well, you started out as a visual artist, mostly in printmaking. I understand that you grew up way out east on the eastern seaboard in rural Nova Scotia in Canada.
Yes.
And so what first drew you into the art scene?
Well, I was an awkward geek. So I was drawing was the refuge, and that was kind of how I could connect to people was through drawing. So I always drew and went to art school. I wanted to go to a place as different from a village on the coast of Nova Scotia as I could possibly think of. So I thought, okay, a city in the prairies. So I applied to the University of Manitoba and ended up in Winnipeg, the smack dab in the middle of the country, where I went to art school and lived there, ended up majoring, focusing on printmaking, on etching, and lived there for the next 12 years.
I think that too many Yanks, too many Americans would say about Winnipeg, where's that? You know, it's just north of Montana across the border there.
Chicago or the north.
Yeah, it's a very cold place on a very big lake, in the winter at least. But it has an amazing film scene. I mean, there's people such as Guy Madden, the director of The Saddest Music in the World, and a huge range of animators, Richard Condy, the Big Snit, Cordell Barker, The Cat Came Back. Did you get to meet any of those people, or were you just not part of the film scene yet?
I wasn't really part of the film scene. Guy Madden, I knew through friends and the Winnipeg Film Group. I actually went to the screening of trying to remember the name of his first film.
Tales from the Gimli Hospital?
Tales from the Gimli Hospital. I went to that screening. Inaugural screening. He's got such an iconoclastic style and very much his own.
He loves the old silent films.
Yes.
Like the Ufa period in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And I think he uses even some of the old film stocks and techniques from that era to try and recreate that sort of Nosferatu style.
Yes.
That was so popular back
then. Yes. And so there's a whole school of that kind of almost gothic style filmmaking. I think it's called Winnipeg Gothic. But I was sort of in the same hood. The thing that was so great about Winnipeg is all the different streams. You know, the sculptors talk to the painters, talk to the writers, talk to the filmmakers, talk to the playwrights. So it was a lovely, there's a lovely homogeneity. And I'm hoping it still exists there, but it's wonderful. There's a lot of discipline crossover, which I didn't really discover. I did discover was the same thing when I moved to Vancouver, which it was a big surprise to me. And I guess because Winnipeg is so isolated, you know, surrounded by miles and miles of freezing prairie, people really do depend on each other and look to each other and listen and read and watch and participate in other people's events. And also, I mean, Winnipeg, that's the prairies, that's the start of the whole cooperative movement. So there really is a much stronger cooperative ethos, I find, in the prairies than once you get to the coasts, where it's a little more Wild West.
Obviously in Winnipeg, it gets crazy cold, wind chill off the prairies. So you're inside a lot doing your art. And I'm assuming you have some opportunities to gather with other artists, although many of your pursuits would be solitary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, there was always a really good potluck, especially in winter. Well, winter and summer. And I found that mainly going through art school, it would be your classmates and their friends that would sort of form your cohort. And again, that would be quite cross-disciplinary, you know, where there would be a group of us who would be writers, visual artists, architects, musicians, filmmakers, the, you know, the gamut. Yeah.
And you were a printmaker at the time.
Yes. I was part of North Nassau Printmakers, which was, again, a small cooperative group of printmakers that was then, the building we were in was turned into actually a big art center, which is now where the Winnipeg Film Group is and a number of other arts organizations. I think it's Martha Street Studios now. And it was a wonderful place to go work where there was common space. We all shared presses and the acids and the, you know, the major infrastructure was there for printmaking. It was in the old district of Winnipeg where there was also, there were theaters and alternate galleries, plug-in gallery. So there was a nice little enclave there of sort of artist-run centers. That was a great area to be in.
I'm thinking that maybe rents were cheaper in the 70s or 80s than they were in, say, Toronto or Montreal.
It was a very livable city. I could live part-time. I worked at the Winnipeg Public Library part-time, and I had a very cute, tiny, tiny little apartment up in the, what, gosh, third, no, was I up in the sixth floor? I was way up there. No, my studio was up in the sixth floor. My apartment was up in the third floor of a very, quite a steep walk up. But it was totally feasible to live and work part-time.
And there's still subsidies in Canada for artists. I have friends up in Vancouver mm-hmm. who have wonderful subsidized artists' lofts. But that's certainly not as big a thing these days as back in the 60s and 70s when there was so much government funding for mm-hmm. The National Film Board of Canada, for example, mm-hmm. and all the other government-run arts programs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, unfortunately, we've been kind of, what would you say, harmonizing with the states and their attitude towards funding. So the National Film Board has shrunk considerably in terms of production. It still has a wonderful presence and it has great distribution. But, you know, in terms of their actual production, I find the production offices have shrunk considerably. The Canada Council is also quite a bit smaller, but and they're also restructuring because everything is so much more interdisciplinary. But I think that's kind of been combined with fewer divisions that you can of funding that you can apply for. But I think that means that the overall pool is, again, there's huge, huge, huge competition for it. So while, yes, we do, we have a combination of provincial and federal funding. It enormous amounts of competition for it. And we don't have the same breadth of private funding that we can go to of different foundations and those sort of options. So, yeah, we have two large pools, and if it's thumbs down, then we're looking for alternate ways to get our work done.
Yeah, it seems like, well, certainly in the States, and maybe this is the case in Canada too, a lot of artists have been forced to be their own marketers and be much more independent and hustle for work.
Well, the whole crowdfunding thing has really come to the fore. And to me, that's almost like all of us just moving our money around from person to person. And hopefully, at some point, we all get a turn. It's great, but there's also a serious danger of sort of crowdfunding burnout. And plus, crowdfunding is for everything now, from serious health crises to research and development for a particular product to arts funding. So again, it's quite a wide open field. And if you're looking to that, then you have to be an absolute wizard of sort of social networking to tap into and be successful in the crowdfunding market.
What techniques, old and new, fascinated you about printmaking?
Well, the thing I loved about etching, I think I've always loved the, my drawing style was always about kind of creating little stories. And what I loved about etchings is that because you're working on a metal plate and you're scratching through an emulsion that you'll then etch, you pull a print and the plate makes a dent in the paper. So there's very much an enclosed world where the story in that etching lives. And also, the image is backwards. So you have to sort of think backwards and how the image is going to look forward. So you end up with this kind of objectivity about the images you're creating. So I love that little enclosed world. And I found that was the same thing once I sort of did this lateral transfer from printmaking into animation. Because I was working with little stories, it seemed the next step was really make those stories come to life, make them move, and also incorporate sound and music. So what I found with film is that there was that same enclosed world in the screen. That became the world the characters could live in. So it made for a much... sort of the next step in the evolution of that sort of storytelling style.
Well, when you did try your hand at filmmaking for the first time with your short film, Play Ball, it was a big success, won awards. And so it sounds like that was when your filmmaking career got launched.
It was wonderful encouragement. I think the first experience, I went to a festival, the Yorkton Short Film and Video Festival, and that's where Play Ball won its the animation award, which absolutely shocked me to no end because I was up against very stiff competition. And also I was there. I was actually able to sort of witness it and meet other filmmakers that I'm actually still friends with to this day. And I think when you get that kind of encouragement right off the bat, it does help you keep making films. And you get to see how people respond to your work in an audience. And that, to me, is also, that's the culminating side of making a film. It's a time-based medium, which is the big difference between that and printmaking. Is, you know, prints, I'm fine with people discovering my prints on their own time and they'll find them. But with film, the film has to be projected. So there's an opportunistic element to that. And also, it's time-based. So people can only experience it for that set period of time.
Well, this is why it's so important to still have cinemas, still have places where people can gather together and watch a film on the big screen, is to connect with the artist in a real way and to have the artist connect with the audience as well and get that feedback. It's almost like the filmmaker is an actor on stage, you know, in the live theater. No performance is ever the same way twice because it's an interaction between the performers and the audience.
Yes, and it's interesting, especially with short film, context is everything. So yes, people bring their experiences to the film when they watch the film, and that can be very much colored by what they've seen before, just before, or what's happening in their life, you know. And so people will resonate with different aspects of a film. And it's always interesting to see when you show a film what people take away from it.
Now, you are known for your short films, and you've had great success with a whole series of short films and often very short films. The market seems to be somewhat not as broad for short films as it used to be. And maybe that's just in the U.S. I think there is still an interest in Europe, in Japan, maybe even in Canada, for short films on television. You know, not everybody needs to go in and make a feature.
Well, it's an interesting thing because I used to have a T-shirt that said short films are the laboratory of film. And what I find is that the short film programs in any festival I go to, that's where I'm most engaged and that's where I see most experimentation. And you see people veering away from the tried and true because there isn't a huge amount of money involved. I mean, once you're into features, then suddenly with all those expenses, even with the cheaper way of making films now, there's a lot more at stake. So people tend to fall back into, well, A, there's a lot more people making decisions about what the story is going to be and how that story is going to be portrayed. I'm all for collaboration, but it has to be creative collaboration. It really can't be about whoever is bringing the money to the table deciding what's going to happen. I think that's where things can really go south, because if you're putting a lot of money into something, then you'll want to get your money back. Whereas with short film, really, it's about the storytelling and it's about the expression. So I find it vital, really vital and alive. You know, hats off to feature filmmakers. I can't wait to see Joanna Priestley's film because I just think, wow, not only did she do a feature, an animated feature, it's an abstract animated feature. That's fantastic. So I'm impressed to that. And it's very, very inspiring, though. I do think I will always be concise and on the short side.
Sound is very important to you. Music, sound effects, ambient audio. And I think this is true of a lot of really successful animation filmmakers, is they realize that sound is half the project. People don't pay as much attention to it, but when it's not there or when it's not done well, it can really sink a film.
Oh, yes. I would almost say that sound is like 60, it's 60-40. Because, and also sound it can really help you establish an atmosphere and a sense of space that you don't have to create because it's there in the sound. And I think sound touches our psyche in a really immediate kind of way. So you can do all kinds of subliminal atmospheric things with layers and layers of sound. And people don't necessarily have to consciously be aware of what that sound is, but it will definitely affect them emotionally in a very subconscious way. Yes, I love working with sound. I love collaborating with sound people as well, especially if they really get it, if they really understand when you describe, here's the sound. Like, I remember talking with the sound person and I wanted the sound of windshield wipers. And I said, but they have to sound like they're coming from inside a car. And he said, oh, mean this. And he put a filter on it and it was perfect. It wasn't just outside windshield wipers. It was from inside. So suddenly that takes you to a different space. So yes. Yes, and also music and animation are just a match made in heaven because they're kind of according to the same mathematics, sort of 12s and 8s and 6s and 24s. And
the rhythm and structure.
The rhythm structure, yes. And so I've done things where, I mean, I have one film that's based on a square dance, so I actually animated it first and I developed the call and then I had, yes, and then I had the musicians play to a line test of the animation. And then I've also gone the other way where I've had music and then I've read the track and gotten the beats of the track and then animated to that. And then I've done the third thing, which is sort of have a starting point, have your music, get started with it, and then just let the animation go. Just go with stream of consciousness animation and then put it together with the music and it will always sync up. It always. In fact, you can take any animation and any piece of music from Nirvana to Tchaikovsky. And if you put the same piece of animation to it, they will sync up. They will start to vibe off each other. They will start to resonate.
There's so much sound available online now, so many sound effects and music clips and things like that. But, you know, decades ago, some of the great audio engineers would go out into the real world, and there are legendary stories like Ben Burtt and the other Star Wars sound people finding discarded televisions that made horrible hums and buzzes, and they'd use that for the lightsaber.
Sure.
Do you have any stories like that?
Oh my gosh, I have many. With my very first film, Play Ball, there's a scene where she's going around this kind of roulette wheel, which is, I guess I was thinking about life and fate. And I was trying to think of how can I make that sound of the roulette wheel? And I ended up rolling a big marble around a colander and got that nice kind of, and then I think I just sort of flanged it a bit. So you got that, you know, effect on it. One time it was wonderful. I got to work with a Foley artist and there.
Now Foleying is where you have somebody playing around, like maybe they're adding the sound for a nature video. So if a bear is splashing around in a screen, they've got their hands in a pan of water.
Yes. Yes. And they have to do it while they're watching the screen. So yeah, I was working with this man who was a percussionist and he was just brilliant. He had a great sense of timing. So he could watch the screen. screen and then replicate footsteps. There was a street person with their shopping cart, and we figured out, okay, what we need is the sound of a couple of cans rattling in that cart. Just all kinds of rustles. He did the most amazing things with like that stretchy flubber stuff and snapping rubber gloves. You know, there are certain things that must be in a Foley person's sound kit, and access to a whole variety of floor things and, you know, high heels and rubber gloves. You know, endless sounds you can get from a few things. It's a real art form. It is. And it's a lot of fun. I always said to students, you know, your kitchen is your best Foley studio because you can do snow with cornstarch and you can do no end of things with pot of water, and you just bang it and you get that swaying gong sound, rubbing the rims of glasses, shaking rice, you know, whacking into a potato or something to get some lovely lethal knife sound. You know, there's all kinds of opportunities. And you're right, a lot of people are just going to online sound libraries, and they have their things like, you know, great gunshots. You don't want to be blasting a gun anywhere, but it's a lot of fun inventing your own sound.
The internet is really a double-edged sword.
Yes.
For short filmmakers. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, you do have a venue. You do have YouTube and Vimeo and mm-hmm. all these other venues for people with short attention spans mm-hmm. to watch your films. On the other hand, you don't have that all-important community audience where you can get immediate feedback with people in the same room.
I know. There's nothing like being anonymous in the audience and watching people experience your film. I had a great experience at the Toronto Film Festival where they were watching my film, Your Name in Cellulite, and they're just giving it up. They're laughing. They're. I can tell they're engaged, and I get to, voyeuristically, I get to just sit there and watch people looking into my brain and enjoying the experience. So, yes, it is quite wonderful to have that audience experience. And the thing I find, it's great to have access to YouTube and to Vimeo, but you still need that curatorial element because there's so much material. So when you look at things that go viral, there's a lot of really amazing stuff, but you'll see it everywhere. So you realize that that curatorial process is still going on. People are depending on other people to show them good material, something interesting to look at. So I think if that can evolve and develop a bit more, then the internet might be a more viable place to find your audience. Because right now it's like screaming into a pillow. You know, you don't know if anyone's going to hear it or see it, and getting it beyond your circle of immediate friends and family and out there, really out there into the world is a challenge. It's a challenge.
Well, your short film, Your Name in Cellulite, is a satire. And so many of your short films are very satirical. And the themes here are advertising culture and marketing and the beauty industry and women's bodies and body image. Mm. And these themes also come up in other films. You know, More Sensitive is another great satirical short film that I like. Obviously, you're inspired by audiences and how they react to that. What are some of your other inspirations? I mean, are you a fan of satirical literature, for example?
Well, I would say what I like to do is sort of draw analogies between the macro and the micro. So with Your Name in Cellulite, it was a combination of how a woman's body is viewed as something that's to be manipulated and shaped and contoured to the purpose of the other, of the observer, of whoever's going to consume this body. That's the same attitude as we have towards the earth, towards we can change the direction of rivers, we can pillage and mine and plunder and clear cut the earth. And the ramifications are the same way that we approach women's bodies and increasingly men's, you know, because that's a whole other market share. You know, we can't miss that. But I really focused on that because it was so apparent to me that when this woman conforms to what is viewed as the prescribed image of femininity, which is also sort of an element of survival, you know, is she's so constrained, so restrained, so immobilized that her body just rebels. And I think the same thing is happening now with the world. The world is just rebelling. You know, we've messed around enough, and now it's just, you know, rolling over and threatening us along with it. It's like we have to smarten up really fast with the environment. We can't treat it in a cavalier fashion. It's not there just for us to use. It's an entity, and we are a part of that entity, not the ruler, not the owner. The same way no one's body is owned by anybody else. And you have to consider the entire ecology. So I think that's kind of more the direction where I come from. The same with More Sensitive. It's based on a film that a friend of mine wrote. It's a jazz singer. It's a self-parody, actually, of himself. He's a brilliant jazz musician, but it's a parody of his singing. And the song is about being more sensitive than everybody else, which in reality the singer isn't. So
sensitive new age guy.
Yes, sensitive new age guy. And you know, when I fall in love, it hurts me more than you can never possibly imagine. So again, I bring in elements of the environment. You know, when he falls in love, it's a box of chocolates and the chocolates explode. And then there's lots of little orca whales that come up. And then the ocean is actually a sea of styrofoam and tampons and detritus. That is the thing I like to play with, is how can we take our immediate personal experience and look at it in terms of the broader context.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm talking today with animator and visual artist Gail Noonan. She's known for her short films that combine music and ambient sound with multiple animation styles and techniques. So many of your films, Menopause Song, Your Name and Cellulite, these are themes that women can immediately relate to, and men can be introduced to these topics in an aha sort of manner. So do you sort of see yourself as an educator, as somebody who's trying to expand the conversation out there?
No, I'm incredibly selfish with my film. I make films I want to see. So I make films and subjects that I'm interested in. I try really not to think of the audience at all. And I don't take a pedantic view at all in my filmmaking. I really like it when things resonate with people. I mean, when I made my film, Your Name and Cellulite, I seriously had no idea that people would respond to it as broadly as they did. I mean, I saw older women saying, I'm throwing out those high heel shoes. I saw fathers saying, I'm going to get this for my daughter. I'm going to get this. Young men saying, I'm getting this for my wife and my girlfriend. It crossed a lot of lines. And I really made that film for something that I needed to see at the time. You know, I was looking at a lot of bizarre plastic surgery, Botox, liposuction. A lot of women were experiencing eating disorders, starving themselves to death. And it was actually realizing that women were dying from these attempts to attain this so-called image of perfection. So it was something I really needed to see. And, you know, with the Menopause Song, I actually wrote the song first, and I wrote it in a really bad day of cramps, and I just needed some kind of relief. You know, this is going to end someday. I was just really expressing something for myself. So when other people vibe into it, that's the best. That's great, because I really don't have any intention, really, of consciously educating or consciously trying to sway anybody's opinion or anything. But if you can come along for the ride, if it actually engages you to watch and to listen, and it makes you think, oh, wow, that's bonus. That's wonderful. I'm happy.
This is the place that creative people find themselves in all the time, writers and artists. They want to find a book, a film, a story to look at, to take in, and it's not there. So, dagnabbit, I guess I'm going to have to make it myself.
Well, it's an interesting state to get in, to think that you can take some concept from a thought and actually bring it to life and bring it to something that other people can see and hear and experience. I think once you make that leap, that's one of the best experiences. I used to teach for a while too, and I would tell my students, you don't have to stay a filmmaker or an animator. The best thing you can know that you can get out of this is that you can take something from idea to completion. And know that you can bring that, something that you has just been in your head, you can bring it into the world. And then other people can share it. Other people will experience this too.
Going back to the idea of sharing with the audience, you know, sometimes an image will just pop into my head, like a dream image or something from my subconscious that pops into my head during a slow day. And I just have to get it down somehow on paper or on film or whatever. And then the fun part is letting other people tell me what it means.
Oh, yes.
You know, because I may have no idea what something means, but other people have no shortage of ideas.
Well, I think if you can tap into that subconscious layer of your brain where all the really wonderful images come from and just let that speak to you, take your inner editor and shut them in the trunk of your car, because you really just need to let those ideas come out. Don't rationalize them. Don't say this means that means that. No, just let those connections happen in that very special language in, I think, the right part of your brain. And it's wonderful when it's unfettered, and you can shape it, certainly do some editing afterwards, but I say just let those images flow and see what connections they make, because that part of your brain is speaking to your other more conscious self. And it gets stifled, I think, a lot of the time in our rational world. We don't really value that kind of thinking. But that's the kind of thinking that I think brilliant inventions come from. You know, it's called thinking outside of the box. But really, it's just letting that one side of your consciousness that's humming away all the time, but we don't have access to it unless we're dreaming or drugs, or, you know, anything that kind of gets through that, lowers the barrier to our normal inhibitions to experiencing that side of ourselves.
In American schools, the first programs to get funding cuts are the arts programs. And it just seems so essential that those are the things we really need. I mean, visual arts and theater and music are the building blocks of language and science and everything else that we think of as part of the STEM program, for example.
I would agree. And the same thing has been happening in Canadian schools as well. And when you bring the element of play back into schools, real play, where people just get to experiment with things, they're learning at a huge... you know, it's not a calculated incremental style of learning. They'll learn about some particular element of physics and science, and then they'll learn about math when they consider timing or frame rates or musical beats. And the physics behind the visual arts and music and sound, just the techniques of making things and how do they sound, and like how do you experience one object, all the different facets of it, like what does something smell, taste, sound like, as well as what does it look like? And what do you learn in the process of doing that? You know, does heat change sound? Does heat change how something moves?
Or cold.
Or the opposing, right, or cold. You know, the sound of crunching snow versus rain versus the sloppy slush that you're sludging through. I mean, there's many, many different things at play when you're seriously considering those elements. And you don't have to consciously teach them algorithms or theorems, but they're getting the same knowledge base. But maybe they just don't have the same terminology to describe it.
Your current home of British Columbia is really a hotbed for some of the issues that you satirize and allegorize. there's extractive industries in British Columbia. There's a lot of mining and timber, and there's also income inequality, expensive rents in Vancouver. But there's huge activism as well. Certainly a very strong feminist wave, a strong Indigenous rights movement. Oh, and there's also the magazine Adbusters, which is based there and takes on many of the same targets that you take on. They take on marketing and negative body image and environmental destruction and exploitation.
Well, it's interesting. I think the latest thing that's come into focus in my world, and actually in British Columbia, is the desire to have clean energy, and also a very strong desire for reconciliation with Indigenous peoples. So we're all living in unceded Native territory. And right now, there's a big argument. There's a dam, Site C Dam, that's about a quarter completed. It was started by the previous Liberal provincial government. And you would think that, oh, great, hydroelectric power, isn't that the best thing? It's not coal. It's not.
It's your electric company is actually called BC Hydro.
It's called BC Hydro, and also it involves flooding a lot of Indigenous and a lot of farmland. So someone is actually paying for this. It's not as clean as we like to think. It's going to do a lot of damage. And yes, we have mining because all the ice caps are melting. That means that a lot of valuable minerals and gas is going to become available for extraction. There's going to be a lot more pressure on the north, and a lot of raw wilderness is going to be subject to economic pressures, because it's now going to be available. But at the same time, there's a growing consciousness that we can't sustain this kind of endless pillaging and development. We're getting to a real critical point now where we have to decide that the environment has to be sustainable, and it has to be sustainable for all sectors of the population here, not just favoring the lower mainland where there's a huge density population. And now, you know, let's send the energy and our water down. So, no, we have to consider the bigger picture, and how can we actually all survive? How can it be really sustainable for everybody?
You lived in Vancouver for many years, and then you moved out to an offshore island, to Main Island. So you're surrounded by sea, much like you were in your younger days on the other side of the country in Nova Scotia.
That's true.
Lots of wind and waves and storms. I'm wondering if you still have an artist community. I know that the great Marv Newland, Bambi Meets Godzilla, he also shares Main Island with you as well.
He does. The interesting thing about Main Island is that people will come and then hide away in their places. Yes, there's a huge social element, but it's also a place where people come to sort of seek refuge, to hide out and do their own work. There are a lot of writers there as well. There's quite a vibrant art and music community there too. It's interesting because, yes, we do come together and we look at each other's work. It was when Marv finished his studio, he actually invited a lot of animation people from Rocket Ship Studios on the mainland. And there's another animator in Main Island, Bill Malone. There used to be a producer from the film board on the island. There were editors. Now, I think I just met a sound person who's just moved on to the island.
Wow, you can just form a studio there.
Yes, you can. You can. And that is the advantage of a lot of digital technology, is that you don't need the huge infrastructure anymore. So I was able to make my last two films at home in my studio. I did have to come off island to actually work with a sound person, but I was able to do the music and get it recorded on island. So it's much more readily available to work away from major urban centers. And people are discovering that. They're discovering, hey, I can escape the huge rents in Vancouver and the traffic and the smog and the density issues. I can actually come to either a rural community or one of the islands.
the techniques that you use in your animation, they're just so wide-ranging. Everything from drawn animation to collage to clay to objects. But the one thing that seems to be missing, unless I've missed something, is I haven't seen any computer-generated imagery from you, no computer animation. So your work seems just very tangible. There's something when I look at your short films, I just sort of imagine being able to reach out and touch everything that's on the screen.
I am a very sort of tactile person, and I've found that computer-generated imagery isn't really something that speaks to me. I've seen other people do it very, very well, but not for me. And the way that you need to engage in just the creative methods for computer-generated imagery and computer animation, you know, working more with graphs and vectors rather than actually moving something a frame at a time. I mean, that's just sort of my tradition and my way of doing things. But I actually did make a computer-generated film. Well, I made it using an Amiga back in 1996. And I discovered...
I remember the Amiga.
Oh, the Amiga was just the best. It really was the best because I was only going to use it as a recording device, as a capture device. And I grabbed an object and I accidentally moved the mouse and it painted with that object. And I realized, oh, this is a tool. You can do things with a computer that you can't do other ways. And I've never really been able to recapture that trying to use After Effects or Photoshop or any of the other sort of currently available programs. I know it can happen. I know. I have a bit of an attitude issue, I think, with them. But anyway, I made that film in 96. I created a sort of set of laws for myself. I could only use 48 photographs of a group that I was singing with at the time and images from gardening catalogs that I got in the mail. And we sang the song. It was a song I'd written called The Menopause Song in a studio on island. It was the latest technology, digital recording, but it was powered off a car battery and one microphone. So we sang around that microphone. And as the light screwed dim, we sang around a candle because there wasn't enough power to have both the light on and this recording and mixing board powered, you know, in this off-grid sound studio. So that's how I made my first only computer-generated film. But then I veered back to my cell painting and very traditional ways and shooting on film.
There's something about those early software packages. You could make mistakes that were really creative.
Yes, that's it. That's it. Whereas now if you make a mistake, it's just torture. You know, and they say, you can just undo. But it's not quite so simple. And you can just get lost in another layer I just found it much easier to translate the gesture of painting and drawing or stamping or your hands-on. It was easier to translate your hands-on ways of working to those early programs. And now, I mean, what I'd like to do is really understand how the programs work, even if that meant getting into the coding. Because like that... You know, when they try to make analogous ways of, you know, brush options and, you know, things for painting mats and things of that nature, I find when they try to make it, sort of the interface just is clumsy. And it's almost better to, let's just figure out how does the computer do this and use its method rather than, you know, creating these kind of clunky mats and outline tracing tools and knife tools. And yeah, to me, it's just kind of crazy making because it's not playful, you know, whereas on the Amiga, I mean, you could do something, you could make a mistake, but you would get a result. Like you would get a visual effect of something. Whereas currently it's just, no, you just create a disaster and you've just destroyed 80 hours of work and it's not viable, is not. But that's my own personal grudge. I know other people have a lovely time with it.
I remember Linda Barry talking about how she had trouble writing a book on her laptop. And then she just got out reams of paper and crayons. Mm-hmm. And that opened it up, just being that tactile opened up something between the mind and the body.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, so your work as a printmaker with all the textures and etching and embossing, it seems like that really informed how you would tackle making a film.
I think I've always been attracted to ritual, and there's a very strong ritual and craft, the element of craft. So there's a very strong ritual in printmaking where you prepare the surface and you bevel the edges and you polish the plate. So you do a lot of work before you ever scratch the surface of the plate. And with animation, there's the same thing where you punch the paper, you create your sets, and also you can do a lot of editing in the storyboard stage. You can do a lot of pre-planning. And then there's that element of repetition. You have to get into kind of a very zen sort of state. And even though I've departed from, I used to quite rigorously storyboard and quite religiously follow that storyboard in my planning process, now I actually try to do what's called straight ahead animation. I just try to intuitively let the images flow as they will. I'll start out with a game plan, but if it departs from that, it can go where it will. But I find that you still get in that particular sort of state of mind, or you're almost in a kind of alternate reality at that point. And I think that follows through from the printmaking as well. Even though it's no longer a literal narrative, you're kind of in the flow of this series of ideas.
Some of my favorite animation directors are traditional artists, not so much the computer effects people. And they're also women. Marjan Satrapi, Nora Toomey, Joanna Quinn. And I think that also has something to say about how women directors have been neglected for so long by the big studios, who are generally more taken with the flashy, shiny things. It's getting better, but it's getting better slowly.
Yes, I agree. And a part of that is, I think there's been an economic imperative behind that. And it harkens back to what we were talking about earlier, how it takes a lot of money to make feature films. And so they must make their money back. And there isn't a lot of faith in a type of storytelling that might be a little more introspective, that might be less sensational, but more taking you along a different experiential path, because it's riskier. And also you're getting into a kind of territory that might make a lot of funders uncomfortable. Excitement, humor's great and horror is great. It engages people in a really obvious, visible, they laugh, they scream. But when you take people on a more thought-provoking and or more emotive experience, then you don't see right away if it's having an impact on people. And I think a lot of the stories that women tell, and this isn't to stereotype them too much, because there's a whole developing genre of women in horror film and in adventure film and fantasy film. It's being really actively promoted too with women in film and video in Vancouver, because we see that there's a dearth of women directors in those areas. But I think a lot of it has to do with, too, you can develop your stories, you can write them down. And if you're Joanna Quinn in that beautiful drawing style, you can draw them. And a lot of women authors started out as short story writers, went to not full-length novels. It's something that you can do in your own time and in your own space. So you're not dependent on external resources as much.
So your short films play at a lot of screenings and festivals and at this retrospective at the Northwest Film Center. But I've been having a hard time finding out where to get hold of a collection of your films. Can you help me out on that front?
In the old video days, I used to have a collection. It was called The Laughing Feminist, which was the first four films. Playball, Two Beautiful Stars, Your Name and Cellulite, and The Menopause Song were on that compilation. And then since then, I've kind of fallen off the wagon of that sort of marketing and very practical, how do you get to see my films? I have a YouTube channel. I have a Vimeo channel. But I'm really amiss. I have two distributors, Women Make Movies. They distribute Your Name and Cellulite. And then there's Moving Images in Vancouver that distributes everything else. But I really have to get a grip on how people can actually see a collection of the films. So that's a good nudge. It's a very good prompt.
Well, tell our listeners how to find out more about your work, please.
Well, I do have a website, Cartoon and Films, CartoonAn Films. And you'll find out about the films there. And I'm starting to develop that site a lot more so that there'll be links to be able to see the films online. Then after that, I'm building a tower and broadcasting from
the tower.
No, okay. Yeah. I'm going to take over the lighthouse on Main Island and broadcast from there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is it a working lighthouse?
Unfortunately, well, yes and no. It has the equivalent of about a 60-watt bulb that's solar-powered that does do its circuit at night. You can see it, but the foghorn has been disengaged. But the building is standing, and they're keeping the area as a park, which is very nice because it's on a beautiful shoreline, gorgeous sunrises and sunsets. So,
okay, you've convinced me. I have to come visit you.
Yes, yes, of course, of course.
Hop a ferry.
Yes, hop a plane, hop a ferry.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today has been animator and visual artist Gail Noonan. Gail, thank you so much for dropping by today.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity. And it's been lovely to visit Portland.
Well, many thanks to all our listeners today on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/words and pictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @words and picture.